Well, good morning and welcome to Green Zine here at Free Vermont Radio, WFVRLP in South Royalton, Vermont. Todd with you, Henry on the way in just a little bit. We have two guests today, so it is going to be a very busy program. One of the earlier segments, we're going to take a quick review of the environmental legacy of the late President Jimmy Carter, who's being honored around the country. I noticed that federal buildings are closed today in honor of that memorial happening down in Washington, D.C. The Allman Brothers, who you're hearing right now, were good friends with Jimmy Carter while he was the governor of Georgia, and were very, actually, instrumental, like we're playing right now, in raising awareness of his candidacy as he was running back in 1976. So I thought it would be appropriate to play this piece from Eat a Peach called Little Martha. Green Zine is brought to you today by Soliflect, also by Bail, Royal Trail Works, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, the White River Land Collaborative, and Wit and Grit. We're very appreciative of all of that ongoing support from many sustainable local businesses and entities here in Vermont. Well, good morning, Henry. I hope you could have heard that over the phone.
I did, and it's lovely. And that that piece between eco shock and the beginning of Green Zine is one of the things that I dropped in the queue many years ago, and it revolves through one of my, hey, I like this music once.
Yeah, that was Siegel Schwall in the day. Yeah, well, thank you for that, Henry.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get right to it. What's on tap today? Yeah?
Yes, so Pat Parento is still suffering from a sore throat, and he thinks he can make it through 15 minutes of interview, so he's going to join us. And
to stop you right there, Pat Parento is the professor emeritus here at the Vermont Law and Graduate School, and is keeping an eye on not only Vermont cases, but also on that case that we're going to talk about in Montana. And then we're going to move on to somebody who's been on the show before.
Zach Porter from Standing Trees, they have a rally coming up in Mendon, Vermont on Saturday from 12 to 1, and we will dig into where that whole issue stands. I don't think there's been a declaration of whether they're going to cut or not cut or what they're going to do. But I know the Forest Service has this enormously meticulous process for deciding what to do, and it says cut. And so we're pushing back against that.
Yeah, a chance.
So we will hear from them.
All right. Very good to hear from Zach Porter again. Well, I'm looking at a bird now that I see quite a few of around feeder in the wintertime. In fact, they are the most dominant population that shows up at the feeder.
I thought this was a good lesson for all of us in how to behave. So I couldn't resist, even it was today's bird note. I couldn't resist running it. I usually run old ones from a year or two or three ago.
Yeah.
But
so sort of a pre-inauguration, how to behave like good little birds. Okay, let's go to bird note now. You're listening to Green Zine here
right at
WFVRLP South Royalton. Why do chickadees come and go?
This is Bird Note. Whether mountain chickadees in the Rockies, black caps in New England, or chestnut backs in the Northwest, chickadees are always worth watching at your feeder. If you've laid out a fine feast of sunflower seeds, you'll see them come in, quickly grab a seed, and fly away. If you watch carefully, you'll see one land nearby, open the seed, and eat the juicy and nutritious kernel within. Now, keep watching that chickadee. It may return immediately, but it's more likely to wait its turn. When a whole flock of chickadees moves into your yard, it looks as if they form a living conveyor belt. One chickadee after another flies to the feeder and then leaves with a seed. When they find a concentrated supply of food, such as a tray of sunflower seeds, the birds are better off taking their turns than all coming in at once and squabbling over the seeds. Nature seems to prefer order to chaos, and we have much to learn from the chickadees. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Definitely familiar sounds there, the chickadees. You got a lot of chickadees up there in Burlington, Henry?
Yes, there's chickadees. And it's interesting, different birds, you know, there are birds that, hey, I want to be the dominant one and come and sit here. And we have I was just trying to come up with the name of them. We have house finches, and they tend to they and the cardinals tend to sit and feed at the feeder rather than making room for another bird. But the chickadees, they don't hang around at the feeder. They occasionally one will sit up on our highest feeder, that's suspended way above the driveway, and they will eat and then stay while they eat. But most of the time, they're off to a tree and standing in the queue after other people have had a chance. It's quite lovely of them.
Yeah.
My favorite bird from a personality point of view. They're just so friendly and so acrobatic and not worried about human interaction.
Yep. Very good.
So, that's good kind of behavior for humans.
Right. And let's move on to someone who's being
I've done my Carter preaching now.
yeah. I was going to say there's
Sunday school preaching.
Definitely a little parallel there as far as knowing how to behave and have integrity and know when to step aside and know when to step up. So we're going to go now during this day when the nation is honoring President Jimmy Carter, who died just a week or two ago at the age of 100. An article written just a few days ago by David Gellis in the Climate Forward section of the New York Times. I'm going to read, I won't read the whole thing, but I'll give you a general idea. Carter's enduring environmental legacy. Well, looking ahead, but not really, when Donald Trump takes back the White House this month, he is expected to roll back many of President Biden's climate policies, canceling incentives for clean energy, promoting fossil fuel production and drilling, and undoing pollution controls. Won't be the first time a Republican president has undone the environmental legacy of his Democratic predecessor. 44 years ago, a strikingly similar story played out when Ronald Reagan replaced Jimmy Carter as commander-in-chief. Just to run down some of the things that happened under the Carter administration in 1979, Carter had, as we know from Gus Speth and other guests, had 32 solar panels installed on the White House roof. While the panels were crude and inefficient by today's standards and powerful enough only to run a water heater, Carter saw what was coming. Quoting him here, "In the year 2000, this solar water heater behind me, which is being dedicated today, will still be supplying cheap, efficient energy." He also set an ambitious goal that by 2000, America would derive 20% of its energy from renewable sources of power, which I think is the case today. Reagan had the 25 years after that, Reagan had the solar panels removed in 1986 and did nothing to support the growth of renewable power in America. Instead, He went all in on fossil fuels. Sounds familiar. In regulatory action, Carter signed more than a dozen major pieces of environmental legislation during his single term in office, including the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977, which sought to minimize the environmental impacts of coal mining. The National Energy Act of 1978 included the country's first incentives for clean energy and measures to promote energy conservation. The Energy Security Act of 1980 went even further to promote alternative fuel sources, including solar energy and biomass. And the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act of 1980, better known as Superfund, created a program to clean up hazardous waste sites and hold those responsible accountable for environmental damage. It goes on from there, talks about the EPA, and of course we know that he was a big supporter of public lands and the national parks and protecting American wilderness. The Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act of 1980 protected more than 100 million acres in Alaska. And with the National Antiquities Act, Carter created several new national monuments, including the Grand Canyon National Monument in Arizona. The article goes on to talk about what Reagan did and, of course, what maybe the incoming President Trump is planning for the environment. But I just thought we would give a tip of the hat of our green hats to the environmental legacy of President Carter.
Yes, indeed. And I think that President Biden has also, at least by executive order, which may get overturned, has added a lot more lands to be protected. I'm not sure he outdid what Carter did, though. Carter captured a lot of land and made it stick in his time in office.
Yeah, he really did. I think we have time to talk about the wildfires, Henry.
Shall we? Yeah, I mean, the California wildfires are pretty spectacular. And from a radio station out in California, I pulled up an article, and the link to this is in the notes for Greenzine. Wildfires have always been part of life in California, where it only rains a few months out of the year. And in fact, this is my side note, this year what happened is it rained a lot in the spring. There was a lot of additional growth, and then we had less than half an inch of rain all the way through until this fire season. And that made a lot of fuel near houses to help make these fires burn. So back to this article. But the same climate has gotten hotter and drier. It's made those fires much larger and more intense. Of the top 20 most destructive wildfires in the state's history, 14 have occurred since 2015. And that's according to the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. And then he goes on just to talk about other fires. And this article is all about what happens financially. So one of the local sheriffs says, I used to pay $1,200 annually for my camp fire. That was before the camp fire. And now it's $5,000 a year, $1,200 to $5,000. And some people with bigger houses are paying as much as $20,000 a year for fire insurance. And the article gets into detail about California's forcing insurance companies to find a way, because they're running away. They're not offering insurance to many people. They're just saying, oh, we can't do that. And so the state's forcing them to take on insurance and allowing them to do forward planning, to look at the climate as it changes ahead, which they haven't been allowed to do before. So if you want to get into more detail. That's in the show notes.
So Henry, real quick question. So you're saying that the government is trying to force them to offer insurance in areas that maybe science and what's been happening over the last 20 years shows are extreme risk. In other words, maybe foolhardy for anyone to keep a house there. Is that what's going on between the government and private landowners?
They're requiring the insurance company are requiring people to do things like clear all the vegetation within 100 feet of their house, and to not allow any pine needle accumulations on their roof or close to the house, because that's what makes the houses burn. It's the fuel that's right at the house. And when there's a cleared zone, then a fire truck can get in there and keep the house cool, and it never burns. So the insurance companies will have the ability to be strict about how people behave with their properties.
I see. And then if they don't comply with those new regs, then the insurance company they can deny insurance then if they don't comply with the regs.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's my understanding of it. Yes.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
A lot going on there.
So,
all right. We're up to.
Well, it's a lot of people who, people are moving because of it, and the cost of insurance will drive people away. And basically, if you don't have insurance, you can't write a mortgage. So new buyers are not in the queues to take up a property. There is a special state, kind of like the federal insurance in Florida. There's a state insurance which is pricey, but is available to people of last resort. But they're trying to have the commercial insurance companies take it on, and people who object to this think that it'll raise everybody's rates across the state, which it may, but the insurance companies basically have been losing money on extreme weather events, whether it's tornadoes or fire or whatever the extreme event is. And it's because they don't have the change that's happening. They're only looking in the rear vision mirror.
Right. Well, it's looking ahead. It's difficult for me to be sympathetic towards insurance companies, but I have one little thread of sympathy in this case, in that if private landowners are acting irresponsibly and somehow can get insurance in an area that's either going to be flooded, washed away, if it's, let's say, on Cape Hatteras or somewhere on where sea level rise is coming, or in extreme wildfire area. But interesting story. So that is at our notes at WFVR.org. Just click on the Green Zine tab towards the bottom. We're up 18 minutes now past the hour of 11 o'clock here on Royalton Community Radio. One other thing, Henry.
I'll go get Pat.
Yeah, you go get Pat, and I'm just going to do a related thing, get a little bit of music going as well. Henry will be back with us shortly. Bring that down. Let's bring this up. Got some music from an alumni of the station. We're wishing him well during a little healthy recovery for him. Neil Fitzgerald underneath me right now. So in today's Herald, not familiar with this writer, Dan Pritchard is his name, and he's talking about an island in South Carolina, which is the fastest eroding beach. I don't know if it's in the United States or on the East Coast. It's known as the Boneyard Hunting Island on the South Carolina coast. And they are setting up a pipeline to bring in sand from offshore, sort of a mixture of seawater and sand, to try to replenish this depleted beach, losing as much as 20 feet a year. So I don't know if you'd call that geoengineering, but an effort to try to preserve that beach. Don't know if it's going to work or not, but a fascinating story. That pipeline can be as long as 4 miles out to where the sand is coming off the bottom of the ocean. I want to bring the music up a little bit, and we'll return with Pat Parento. And actually, I'll give you one more local note here before we bring Pat Parento on. And I'm tossing the Herald around, realizing I had the right section with me. Yeah, here it is. So a lot of our towns have conservation commissions, which is a good thing. I imagine some conservation commission members may be at this protest on Saturday that Standing Trees is putting together regarding the telephone gap plan from the National Forest Service. Well, there'll be talk mostly about birds and national parks coming up next Friday. So that will be the 17th of January. It's entitled Bird Monitoring in Our Local National Parks. Tunbridge Library and the Tunbridge Conservation Commission are collaborating on this while they celebrate National Park Service Month here in January. There's also art up there to frame the talk, an extensive exhibit of national parks and public lands landscapes. Paintings by artist Joan Hoffman are on display right now, right through the end of the month. Joan has been an artist in residence at the Yosemite National Park, Marsh Billings National Park, Zion National Park, and Crater Lake National Park. Should be an interesting discussion of birds and national parks with Tunbridge's own Aaron Weed. Let's see if Henry's back with us. Henry, are you there?
I am here, and excellent. I have Pat Parento with us, and he says that his tongue is not behaving itself, and but he sounded pretty good to me. So if his voice shuts down, we'll fill
the gap. Hey,
and fill the gap,
Professor Parento. It's a real honor to have you on the air, and of course you spent a lot of time right where we sit now on the campus of the Vermont Law and Graduate School. So welcome to Green Zine.
Hey, thanks. Good to be with you.
Yeah. So with your legal expertise, I'm just fascinated to hear what your thinking is on these two different cases, the Montana Supreme Court decision that gave the next generation of children the right to have an inhabitable world. That's a very broad stroke of it. and the event with the state of Vermont trying to generate a Superfund site Superfund that the big oil companies would pay for, and now the big oil companies are starting to lawyer up and get back and countersue, and so where these are going and what hope do we have for them, and what can we do, if anything, to make this process even more impactful than it is now?
Right. Big questions, right? So both of these cases involve precedent-setting moves in response to the climate crisis. So talking about the Montana case first, this case is called Held, H-E-L-D, versus Montana. It's the first time a court in the United States, namely the Montana Supreme Court, has ruled that there is a constitutional right, in that case based on the Montana Constitution, to a stable climate. That's the phraseology of the court's decision, stable climate. And they found this right in Montana's what we call Green Amendment, which is a 1972 amendment to their constitution, which states every citizen has a fundamental right to a clean and healthy environment. There are 8 states with these green amendments. New York recently adopted one. Pennsylvania has had one for many decades, and some other states. Vermont talked about adopting such an amendment that didn't really go anywhere. So the first thing to say about this is it is a landmark. It is historic. No, as I say, it's the first court in the United States. There have been decisions by courts in other countries, particularly in Europe, but also in South America, in Africa, in Pakistan, that have recognized constitutional rights, human rights, to a safe climate, but not in the United States. In fact, all the efforts before the Held case have failed. Most famously, the Juliana case in federal court was dismissed, trying to establish a federal constitutional right to a, quote, climate system capable of supporting human life on Earth. So that's what makes the decision of Montana Supreme Court a precedent. But then the flip side is, what does it actually mean, right, to recognize a constitutional right? And here I have to say the Montana Supreme Court, you know, issued a fairly modest order. It basically told the state of Montana it could no longer refuse to consider the climate impacts of all of the fossil fuel development that occurs in Montana. You have to understand, Montana now has the largest reserves of coal of any state in the United States. And it has many coal mines, many coal-fired power plants. And of course, it also has a tremendous amount of oil and gas. And the state's energy policy is to develop it all. It's drill, baby, drill. The governor of Montana, Gianforte, is in lockstep with Trump on these issues, and the new about-to-be Secretary of Energy, Burgum, the governor of North Dakota. So that's where the disconnect comes from. The court is saying there's this constitutional right, but the political establishment of Montana is hell-bent to continue developing all of its fossil fuel resources. So the court did not tell Montana to stop that, to get on a different track, to adopt different, more clean technology, energy policies. It didn't do that. It simply said to the state, you must stop and think about what you're doing and calculate the, as best you can, the impacts. Hello?
Yeah.
Are you still there?
Yeah.
No, we are here.
I thought I lost you. Okay, so let me finish that off.
Okay.
So, you know, a follow-up case by the Montana Supreme Court is worth noting. In a case challenging the issuance of a permit to allow a big coal-fired power plant to keep operating, the state once again said, we're not going to consider climate impacts. We're just going to reissue the permit for this plant. And the Supreme Court of Montana did say that's not good enough. You've got to go back now, in light of our ruling in the Held case, and reconsider your decision to permit this plant and take into account and quantify, again, using models as best you can, quantify what the emissions from this plant going forward for the next X number of years is going to be and what the consequences for Montana's environment. You think about fires, you think about water, you think about agriculture, you think about tourism, et cetera. You think about the fact that Montana has some of the best trout fishing in the world. I know this because I've been there, right? So you know, that's what the court has said, is you got to be doing a better job of taking all of these consequences into account, with the idea that eventually it will result in a change of heart, right? A change of policy in the state. But we don't know that. So the Montana case for now is limited both to the state of Montana and limited in terms of its effect on changing energy policy. It could be adopted. The reasoning of the Montana Supreme Court is quite good, quite thorough. It could be adopted in some of these other states with green amendments like New York or Pennsylvania or perhaps others. So that's a positive sign. Maybe this is the start of a trend. It's too early to say. Of other state court decisions recognizing a constitutional right. We know we're not going to get that out of the federal Supreme Court. We know that. So the only hope for a constitutional argument in favor of climate mitigation and adaptation is going to be through state courts. So that's enough on the Hill case, unless you want to pop in with
Yeah, quick question is, what happens if the that new coal-fired power plant that was going to be just signed off on, if they do a woefully bad job of
collecting data,
collecting the data and you know, they just really thumb their nose at it.
Yeah, I think you can expect that, frankly. I think what you're going to see is a series of litigation similar to what we've seen over the years with our own federal National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, of course, Environmental Impact Statements. Montana has what's called a little NEPA. They have their own state law, MEPA, they call it. I would expect the state not to do a very good job, and B, for the environmental plaintiffs like Montana Environmental, Information Center, MEIC, to follow up with further litigation. But again, these kinds of cases, we call them procedural cases, right? Mm. It's keep working on your analysis. It's not stop what you're doing. That's the problem.
Right. You need to move it up a level. Okay.
Yeah let's go to.
How about the Vermont Climate Superfund law adopted by the last legislature and now in the process of implementation? So that's a precedent. Okay, so Vermont's the first state in the country to adopt a Superfund model for assigning liability to, in this case, the oil companies, at least companies that emit a billion tons a year, which, frankly, a lot of them do. You know, there's research that shows that there are about 90 companies in the world that are responsible for about two-thirds of the emissions in the atmosphere. So, you know, that $1 billion ton figure sounds like a lot, but it's actually not. So a lot of oil companies like Exxon, Shell, BP, and others will trip that $1 billion trigger. It's precedent-setting, first time. Now, New York has just adopted, and Governor Hochul has just signed in the last few months, its version of a similar Superfund-based law. That's very good news, because, as I'm going to say in a minute, Vermont's going to need all the help it can get to defend this law. And Massachusetts is considering a law similar, so is California, and maybe some other states will as well, all of which would be good. The more the merrier when it comes to, you know, assembling the kind of army, frankly, of lawyers and experts you're going to need to defend and implement and enforce a law like this. So I'm very familiar with the Superfund model. I was regional counsel with EPA Region 1 in New England for many years, several years in the 80s, right when Superfund was being implemented. So we were responsible for a lot of the early leading cases, including one, Cannons Engineering, which involved an interlocked four different sites, put it that way, and over 1,000 responsible parties. So it was a huge case at the time. And it took 5 years to finally resolve that case through a whole bunch of litigation, you know, lots of science and technical assessments and lots of models trying to assign responsibility in proportion to the various parties that were involved. I'm telling you this because that case, it was incredibly complicated for the time, and yet it's nothing compared to what Vermont's trying to do with the Climate Superfund law, because now you're talking about global emissions, and you're talking about allocating responsibility to these individual oil companies, and you're talking about how to calculate the damage to Vermont. You can think primarily flooding, because that is the big impact so far that we've been able to observe with our own eyes, right?
Right.
And quantify. I mean, you know, the 2023 flood caused $1 billion worth of damage in Vermont. That wouldn't be, as we say, a pee hole in the snow in California or Florida, but that's a lot of money in Vermont, right? So here's the thing that I've been trying to tell people. The law is great. I support it. It's polluter pays. It's cost recovery. It's right down the line with what the law ought to be, and that's the operative term, ought to be. Mm-hmm. So what we don't know is what the law is, okay? So this is all cutting-edge stuff. It's going to be years. I'm trying to warn people, and I don't mean a few years.
No.
I mean 5 to 10 years of incredibly expensive, difficult, fractious, nasty litigation. I know this because I'm involved with some of the other climate liability cases that have been pending now for over 10 years, okay? So this is a really long slog. These oil companies, led by Exxon, will not spare anything. They will come at you with everything they've got. And sometimes they actually go after individuals in the states. They've sued the Attorney General of California. They've sued the Attorney General of Massachusetts.
Wow.
They've sued the Attorney General of New York. They don't play nice. They play rough. And it's going to cost high seven figures. The legislature needs to be prepared, and the governor, to stay with this and not give up. Because what the oil companies are going to, and Exxon in particular, it's all about intimidation. It's all about, you know, winning through attrition. So the state better be prepared for a really long, difficult, expensive battle. And you won't know the outcome for many years.
Right.
And do you think it will push just the shot across the bow piece, will push the oil companies to think about being energy companies instead of fossil fuel companies?
Well, they will tell you that in their PR, but no, if you look at their budget, no. They're doubling down, tripling down on finding new sources of oil and gas deposits around the world. Of course, the Arctic is almost ice-free. It will be in the next 10 years, according to the science. But it's already open to much more exploration. So they're looking for more places to extract and exploit. They're not investing heavily in anything other than plastics. They are arguing that they're diversifying their portfolio by investing in plastics. Thank you very much. As if we didn't have a massive plastics problem in the world, right? So no,
right.
They are not serious, not at all serious about shifting to a real green energy economy.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised to hear about that. So Pat, if more and more states, like you said, we might be up to 7 or 8 states that have sort of these super fun, like if that continues to grow, is there a chance of sort of those states forming sort of a class action defense against the oil companies, or every state is on its own?
Every state is on its own. There's no class action that would apply in this kind of a case, but the states can pool their resources.
Mm-hmm.
And trust me, Vermont does not have either the personnel, and I mean no disrespect to the Attorney General's office. Three of their key environmental people are products of my program at Vermont Law School, right?
Yep.
So I have great confidence in them as individual lawyers. They're just up against an army.
Right.
I'm talking about hundreds of lawyers on the other side who's you know, hourly fee is in excess of $1,000. These are some of the meanest, nastiest, but best lawyers on the planet. You have to understand that. And they have an open checkbook to hire whatever expert they want who will tell them whatever they want to know and put them on the stand in the lawsuit. So that's the reality of litigation. I've been a litigator my whole life. I believe in litigation. I also understand its limits and how difficult it is to win these cases.
Mm-hmm. All right. So any advice to us besides saying, hey, persist? It seems to me that the oil companies are really deciding to push us over the waterfall and to hell with it.
Yeah. Well, plan and budget and you know, be willing to stick with it when it looks like the exit is the way to go, right? To just say, I'm going to cut my losses and get out.
Yeah.
You know, that will happen. It won't happen today, tomorrow, next year, the year after. 5 years from now, it might.
Yeah. Well, the governor certainly wasn't too anxious to see this
no,
lawsuit take place.
No, and that's the problem. And I don't think the legislature appropriated, I forget, 300,000. Maybe there was two batches of 300,000. I don't know what the final tally was. That's all just, the preliminary assessment of what the damages are and coming up with a cost figure, right? That's a drop in the bucket,
right.
Literally. That's a drop in the bucket. So the legislature needs to be thinking seven-figure appropriations yearly. That's what they need to be thinking.
Yeah, in a state where affordability was a major factor in this recent election. It's going to be a tough battle up there under the Golden Dome, Pat.
Yeah, anyway, that's probably enough for now, right?
Excellent.
That's enough.
Appreciate it.
Good news and depressing news at the same time.
That's climate for you. Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us on Green Zine. Really appreciate the ground zero level picture you have of these suits.
Good. Keep it up, guys.
All right. Appreciate it, Pat. All right.
Thanks. Yep. See ya.
Professor Emeritus Pat Parento from the Vermont Law and Graduate School, keeping up the good fight for many, many years, making a reference back to the mid-80s. Wow, that's a long slog. Henry, I'm going to let you go grab our next guest, and we're going to go to this piece from Tom Paxton. We'll just say it goes out to the fossil fuel industry.
Humankind has survived some disasters for sure, like locusts and flash floods and flu. There's never a moment when we've been secure from the ills that the flesh is heir to. If it isn't a war, it's some gruesome disease. If it isn't disease, then it's war. But there's worse still to come, and I'm asking you please, how the world's gonna take any more? In 10 years, we're gonna have 1 million lawyers, 1 million lawyers, 1 million lawyers. In 10 years, we're gonna have 1 million lawyers. How much can the poor nation stand? The world shook with dread of Attila the Hun as he conquered with fire and steel. And Genghis and Kublai and all of the Khans ground a groaning world under the heel. Disaster, disaster, so what else is new? We've suffered the worst and then some. So I'm sorry to tell you, my suffering friends, of the terrible scourge still to come. In 10 years we're gonna have 1 million lawyers.
Well, that song was written quite a while ago, and certainly this country, just on its own, has a lot more than 1 million lawyers, and of course a lot of lawyers that are fighting for some principles and values that are very important to all of us in the environmental world. Let's see if Henry's been able to get a hold of Zach Porter from Standing Trees. Are you back with us, Henry? Maybe not. We'll bring back Tom for a little bit longer.
Lawyers in restaurants, lawyers in clubs, lawyers behind every door, behind windows and potted plants, shade trees and shrubs, lawyers on pogo sticks, lawyers in politics.
All right, I'm going to stop it right there. That pogo stick line makes me think of another local fractious issue that involves not a million lawyers, maybe just a couple of lawyers. Let's check in again with Henry. Tom Paxton. Are you there, Henry?
I am, and we have Zach Porter on with us from Standing Trees, Vermont. And Standing Trees has been standing up for old growth forests. And there's an upcoming rally on this Saturday from 12 to 1 at the Mendon Ranger Station. So we want to cover that, and we want to find out what the situation is with protecting older trees and forests of trees in Vermont and why we should care. So welcome to Green Zine, Zach.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, welcome back, Zach. Yeah, looking forward to getting your update on what's happening over there with the telephone gap.
Well, sadly, despite a record number of comments, more comments than have ever been submitted on any project in the history of the Green Mountain National Forest, almost all of which were in opposition to this massive, reckless, destructive logging project, the telephone gap project, the Forest Service is moving forward with a project that has not been changed nearly enough, from 12,000 acres of proposed logging to 11,000 acres of logging. 11,000 acres, if that doesn't mean a lot to people, the city of Burlington, Vermont is 9,000 acres in size. So wow. This is a massive amount of real estate that is going to be cut. Real estate that we all own in common. These are public lands. The Green Mountain National Forest is not a major source of wood products. It's about 1% of the total annual wood harvested in Vermont that comes from the Green Mountain National Forest. And this is just one of a half dozen logging projects that are either ongoing or currently under consideration by the Green Mountain National Forest. So, you know, what's staggering here is it's a huge logging project targeting some of the oldest and healthiest forests in the state of Vermont. And yet, if we said no to this project, it would have almost no impact on the availability of wood products for our wood product economy in this state. So the choice to me and to so many others seems really clear. We don't need to be pitting the healthiest forest that we all own in common against the idea that we should be protecting some of our forested landscape so that it can continue to grow old. And right now, there is no better place where we should be making a stand than the Telephone Gap Project. And that's why we're getting together with many others from across the region this Saturday, like you said, asking people to arrive at 11:30 to help with the parking logistics, but at the Green Mountain National Forest headquarters in Mendon on Route 4. So we'd love to see you there.
All right. So how is the word going to get back to the decision makers that people are showing up? How does this play out?
Well, we've been sending that message for quite a while now. To anybody who has been following this, you know, there's been stories in not just our local papers over the last 3 years, right, that this has been under development. But now there's been stories in the Boston Globe. There was a story over the summer in the Guardian. I mean, there has been no way to miss, from the local level to the national level, the significance of the Telephone Gap Project as a national poster child for what the U.S. Forest Service is doing wrong with public land management. And, you know, we are, you know, thankful that our delegation has spoken out on several occasions, the congressional delegation, on the importance of mature and old-growth forests over the last 3 years. But what they haven't yet done is to take a stand on this specific project that's right in their backyard, in their purview here in Vermont. And so we do need the help of everybody who cares about this issue, whether you can make it to the rally or not, to call on our delegation today. Ideally, you know, we could see action before the Biden administration leaves office to put a stop to this madness. This is our last best chance right now to get executive action to cancel this project. It's only going to get harder after the transition. So, you know, we hope people will pick up the phone and, you know, send a note to, you know, Representative Vallant, to Senator Welch and Senator Sanders, asking them to help make this right, that we don't need to be sacrificing our public forests in this way. So that's the opportunity before us right now. And it is a tragedy that despite the amazing awareness and pushback that we're still stuck in this position. And it's just a sign of how intransigent the Forest Service is and how hard it is to shift an agency like this onto a new path, sadly.
So the Biden administration asks that all agencies consider climate change in their work. And it seems like the National Forest doesn't bother with that one. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, this is the perplexing situation that we're in. You know, without very explicit instructions, you know, state and federal agencies both are very good at accounting for what's going to happen and then not doing anything about it. And so here in the case of the Green Mountain National Forest Telephone Gap Logging Project, the Forest Service calculates that this project, this one project, will release as much carbon as 60,000 gas-powered passenger vehicles over a single year. That's 12% of the gas-powered cars in the state of Vermont, registered in the state of Vermont. That is how much carbon will be released by this one logging project. That is a teeny tiny portion of the overall logging that goes on in Vermont in any given year. And yet we have complete say over this logging project, unlike most of the logging that happens in Vermont each and every year. And so the Forest Service is telling us, actually more clearly than they ever have before, this is new for the Forest Service, how much carbon will be released. And it is a gargantuan amount of carbon. But unfortunately, information isn't enough. We need action. And so we've got this information in hand, and it's going to be up to our elected officials and to appointed officials and you know, appealing to the better nature of the leaders at the Green Mountain National Forest to do something substantive with that information. Otherwise, unfortunately, it just becomes kind of a check-the-box exercise. And that's where we are right now.
Yeah, this sounds a little similar to our discussion with Pat Parento earlier as far as, yeah, the data will come in and then it'll be just business as usual. So, Zach, if in an ideal world going into this years of feedback coming in from the public, from Standing Trees standpoint, what do you think would be a reasonable but very responsible as far as carbon capture and release? You mentioned they're only going to, you know, they reduced it by 1,000 acres. What do you think is a more reasonable proportion there?
I mean, when you look at the fact that the Green Mountain National Forest, like I said earlier, provides 1.3% of the total harvested wood products in Vermont mm-hmm. each and every year, when you consider the fact that Vermont cuts 150% of the wood volume that is actually consumed within the state of Vermont every single year. We don't need wood from our public forests for commercial uses. It is a fool's errand. We are losing taxpayer money on logging projects that are destroying a resource that we all depend on and that we need more than ever before. And so absolutely there would be ways to modify this project to make it less damaging, but our proposal here is quite a bit simpler than that, which is let's change the paradigm of public land management. And we simply don't need to be using the Green Mountain National Forest as a you know, extractive resource base like we treat, you know, other federal lands for oil and gas leasing, et cetera. We should be keeping those resources intact. And now we have plenty of information to know that it provides greater economic benefit to us intact, left to grow old, than it does cut into pieces and sold off to the highest bidder. So, you know, to us it seems pretty simple. And, you know, we certainly hope that in the years ahead we're going to start to see even more public, you know, opinion changing on this and our leaders taking a stand for a new way of managing our public lands. But in the short term, we're looking for a cancellation of this project, and at the very least, the removal of the most egregious parts of the project. 800 acres of old-growth forest are proposed to be cut in the Telephone Gap project, 2,000 acres of what are called an inventory of roadless area in the project area. So, you know, just removing those pieces of it would make the project better, but it would sure still be a long way from a project that, you know, would be ideal in any you know, sense of the word for us. But there are ways to make it better than it is right now. And there's time for those changes to happen. And the more pressure that we can mount, the better.
So let's say the congressional delegation, all three members, are in agreement, and they take all these phone calls, emails, et cetera. Who are they? Are they talking to the head of the United States Forest Service to stop this project, or what's the step that they're taking?
So it is a, you know, decision that the local district ranger, who is based out of the Rochester and Middlebury Ranger District, gets to make. That's okay. Where the buck stops with the Telephone Gap project.
Oh, and so that's why we need to be there.
Right. So that's why it really does matter when you have pressure from on high. That is what can sway the decision making of the U.S. Forest Service. And, you know, we have a powerful delegation We have delegation members who I know care deeply about these public forests. Now is the time to show that concern. Now is the time for pressure on the local ranger district staff, as well as on the chief of the Forest Service. So that's what needs to happen in the short term.
So I will put in the notes the phone numbers for each of those offices. And I highly recommend that people just pick up the phone and say, hey, don't cut the telephone gap. You don't have to get into detail. You just need to say, hey, take some action and do that. And then we'll have to put some pressure on those offices to see that they've done it.
Endless pressure, endlessly applied. That's the recipe for protecting public lands. It's a steep trail that we have ahead of us to change the way that these lands are managed. But it doesn't take that many people calling in to these offices to make a real difference and to make people notice. So we appreciate any calls that your listeners can make in the days ahead.
All right, Zach Porter from Standing Trees. Really appreciate you taking some time out at sort of short notice to join us, and we hope you get a great turnout, and I'm getting ready to go make my phone calls.
Well, thank you.
All right. Excellent. So, yeah. All right, onward. Thank you, and hopefully we will be seeing you on Saturday.
Looking forward to it. Yeah, take care.
All right, thanks, Zach.
Good. Bye-bye.
All right, we've got about 3.5 minutes left in the show. Henry, I've got something in front of me, but do you have something you want to get out as far as upcoming?
No, I think I'm good.
Okay. So I'm sure you get these as well, Henry, from the Vermont Natural Resources Council. And, of course, the governor gave his opening speech, opening up the legislative session for 2025. And VNRC is sending out a legislative look ahead as far as what they want to get involved with. And I'm just going to go to the bold parts of these. So you can go to the VNRC website to read it in its entirety. They are hoping, we were talking about the Global Warming Solutions Act with Professor Parento, and they will work to ensure that Vermonters can access climate smart solutions like EV incentives, public transit, heat pumps, weatherization, and solar energy that will help improve long-term stability and affordability for families and communities. That's one bullet point from the VNRC. Also working towards that the state invests in effective implementation of the Flood Safety Act. And as Professor Parento said, that is clearly some on-the-ground evidence of fossil fuel activity affecting the state of Vermont. Also, ensuring a longstanding commitment to clean water for all by looking to enact better regulatory systems for farm pollution, which is difficult here in Vermont, and chloride pollution from road salt. The legislature must continue to look for ways to invest in and implement smart growth principles, and we know there's a little bit of progress there. Also, final bullet point, they will continue to work to protect public health from toxic chemicals, and this one's for Carol over in Sharon, and plastic pollution. And we all know about PFAS. So pretty big plate there for VNRC and the rest of us to fight for during the upcoming or the current legislative session. Find out where your members, what committees they're on, and get involved at the grassroots level, like one of the other tags that you put up from Volts at our website, Henry.
Yes, indeed. There is lots to be able to be involved here. And I'll put a link to that story that Todd just covered also in the notes. So that'll give you, the VNRC is out there to, they're right next door to the legislature, and they campaign. They go in and talk with people and jawbone and try to get legislation that's sensible across. So worthy agency to support.
All right. And hey, quick, who are we going to have on next week, Henry? Tell the folks.
Yes, indeed. We are doing wildlife next week. We have Aaron
Weed.
Give me his name.
Aaron Weed. Yep.
from the natural resources?
No, Billings Billings Farm National Park, just over in Woodstock. Yeah. Going to be talking about birds.
Go ahead and do it.
Well, he's going to be talking about birds and other national park issues, and that's all happening. Well, he's going to be on the air with us next Thursday, and then he will be giving a presentation at the Tunbridge Public Library next Friday night, the 17th. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!